Welcome to Voluntary Values on LRN, the Liberty Radio Network. We are here live every Sunday from 3 to 5 p.m. This is Daryl.
And this is Emberly. Hey, guys, welcome to the show. And make sure that you like us on Facebook at the Voluntary Values page and that you visit us on the website at voluntaryvalues.com, where you can get updates on what we're doing on the show and other information. All right.
And today we are going to start the show slightly differently than how we normally do. We are going straight to the phones with a special guest, Sire Voluntarist.
Yay!
He is one of roughly 600 real-life superheroes. Sire, tell us how you became a superhero.
Well, it was actually one late night when I was doing a summer internship. I kind of had the inspiration that it was time to take my voluntary values and put it into a form that others could appreciate and I really enjoyed. So I began developing some characters. I went ahead and made a couple of costume designs and had them produced and took it from there.
All right. So you're actually part of a superhero group, correct?
Yeah, you might say that, although I don't know that our powers of persuasion are necessarily super, but some might say they are.
Well, for those that aren't aware, there actually are some people that dress up in costume and go out. They don't have superpowers, but, you know, they play the role of superhero.
And, yeah.
I was listening to NPR not too terribly long ago, and during one of the shows they did, they were interviewing a real-life superhero from Toronto by the name of Ethanos, who dresses up as Death.
Wow.
And goes out and feeds the homeless.
Oh, that's cool.
That's awesome.
I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, but they were talking about him and other superheroes, and there's actually a bunch of different superhero organizations for the real-life superheroes. Are you a member of any of these organizations? Do you have any interaction with other superheroes?
Actually, not of those type, although what they do is great. Absolutely love what they do because they go around and they visit sick children in hospitals. They help feed the homeless and things like that. What we kind of did was focus on waking people up to voluntary living and voluntary values, and that was largely through getting people's attention, doing with signs, doing fun videos, little music, and things like that. And, of course, now the next project that we're working on is on producing a comic book that integrates voluntarist values, the non-aggression principle, and other things like that into a comic theme where the hero is pitted against the government as the government tries to enslave humanity once and for all.
Okay, so tell us more about this project. You have something set up on Indiegogo where you're doing some fundraising?
Yeah, so what happened is, you know, after doing the costume thing in real life for a while, kind of realized that I had a new medium with which I could communicate voluntary values and how people can live peacefully. And it, to me, it was just natural because I have a huge affection for comic books and dressing up and, you know, Marvel, DC, things like that. And so I just said to myself, well, it doesn't appear that anybody's done this before, so I might as well go ahead and make it happen. So I started doing some sketches, wrote scripts, wrote a backstory, and then went ahead and worked with some artists to, you know, make those initial sketches and make it happen. And now we're just taking it to the next level, inviting people to come help, support, make it happen, and bring together a new medium for promoting the voluntarist message.
Right. I see on the Indiegogo site that you have, which is indiegogo.com/vault comic, that you've raised $1,148 of the projected $4,000 goal, which is really great, and you still have 35 days left on the campaign.
Yeah, actually, it's been incredible. We had a lot of support within 24 hours. Over 1,600 people immediately liked the page and raised over $1,000 then. And we even have some direct donations. So in addition to what you're seeing on there, we had some people who just directly donated through PayPal on the website. So nice. The support's been great. It seems like this is something that people do enjoy, that, you know, I'm not the only person who enjoys comics and voluntarism. So I'm really looking forward to seeing this come to fruition, and we're going to take it as far as we can. So in other words, as far as we could fundraise for is as far as we'll take the comic book for now, and I'm going to keep investing my time and resources into it and see what happens.
And I noticed that you have different perks that you're offering. Can you tell us a little bit about the perks and how that sort of entices people to donate?
Oh, absolutely. Well, first and foremost, the comic in PDF form is our, you know, number one way to support, because that's getting the message out, bringing it into existence, and people who are donating are going to get that right away. So they're going to get that comic first before everybody else does when it's publicly released. And what's going to happen is after the campaign's over, we got to, you know, of course, work on the comic for about 6 weeks, I believe. And then we'll be able to send that out. But those who do donate for the comic get the comic first. There's also other things like getting voluntary stickers. We have buttons. We have print reprints of a couple of the characters, one of which is, you know, designed by a famous artist, Rob Dumo, and another famous artist who worked for Image Comics, J.C. Grant. So we have a couple of different ways that you can support, you know, whatever you're comfortable with. You could still get a little, you know, gift thing out of it. But it's really about making the comic come into existence, because I really want to make it public. I want it to be something that people can share and, you know, add to it and modify and grow, because it's more about the underlying message, just really showing what government's doing in, you know, in our time and what needs to be done to change the flow of things.
And I noticed that you have a very special perk. For those with deeper pockets, they can actually become a comic book character?
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, there's already been one person who's wanted that.
Nice.
What happens is for the comic book character, you'd be able to be in this one specific issue, come in as a comic character, and you could choose, you know, whether they're friendly toward the main character, possibly a foe, or just someone that's, like, in the background that kind of you could see and, like, point and say, oh, that's me. So, you know, it's just a great way to, you know, get yourself involved. There's also a banner page if someone wants to, you know, put in their advertisement, of course, PG-rated, because I'm not exactly making something that's very gratuitous in forms of, you know, sex and violence, but it's like traditional superhero genre things, like you'd imagine Superman or Batman. So action, adventure, storyline, but still bring forward the message of voluntarism and also fleshing out the philosophy of voluntarism. And I mentioned this in a couple different venues, but what's really cool about the superhero context is that it brings out how voluntarism is carried out in situations where we as humans are not exactly sure how, you know, what the limits are. Because the superhero in the story, who gains his superpowers rather of recent, has to flesh out how far he's willing to take his powers to defend himself, because he's not really sure of his limits. And, of course, he doesn't want to die and he doesn't want to hurt others. And a lot of the way this correlates down to us is that when we have to deal with situations where property rights are violated, obviously someone doesn't want to be blown away for a simple trespass, and that's not how voluntarism is carried out. You know, do as much as you need to in order to remedy the harm, but without taking it further. But, you know, how far does that go? Just like superpowers of a superhero go, you know, we might have tasers, we might have pepper spray, we might have things like that, so it's... You kind of wonder what are the limits to defending oneself, one's property. And so that's just one little tidbit as to how voluntarism is fleshed out, but in a superhero format.
Now, is this going to be a graphic novel, like a one-time print, or is it going to be sort of a monthly or quarterly comic that comes out on a regular basis?
Sure. Right now, the comic that we're producing is going to be a traditional formatted comic, somewhere hopefully between 12 and 16 pages. So it'll be single issue with the hopes of making more, or possibly even having it in a web series, you know, like a 3-6 cell strip at a time. Just whatever we can make happen.
Hi,
and
sire.
Keep the storyline going with.
We have a break coming up, so if I can hold you over to the next segment, we'll be right
Absolutely.
Back on Voluntary Values.
Sounds great.
Well, Welcome back to Voluntary Values with Daryl and Amberly on the Liberty Radio Network. And we are joined by Sire Voluntarist, a real-life superhero who goes around promoting voluntarism and voluntary interaction. He does this dressed as a superhero. And he's absolutely also working on a project to put out a webcomic. What was the title of that comic again?
The title of the comic is Voluntarist. It's the name of the main character, and okay, he adopts that name as his superhero name.
Nice. All right, well, I was checking out your website, thevolcomic.com, and I saw that you had on a teaser. And so I read that, and I was just like, wow, I really want to read more. I want more. I want more. I don't even need the drawings. I just want more. But the drawings, of course.
I'm glad you like that.
Yeah, of course the drawings will make it even more exciting. And, you know, I have four nephews that are all under the age of 13. So this would be something that I would love to give to my nephews as Christmas presents or birthday presents. So this is fantastic.
Oh, no, I'm glad you like it. And actually, my demographic for this comic was supposed to be, you know, 13 plus. It's something that is supposed to, you know, be like something that anybody could pick up and read, mm-hmm, and enjoy and relate to. It's not really meant to be something that really is like adults only. It really is something that I would like, you know, for young people to be able to enjoy, but also for adults to be able to enjoy.
Nice.
And as you probably saw from the teaser, that was actually written as part of how this kind of started was with a film script I was working on, and I started to realize, wow, you know, this is going to be pretty darn exciting and epic. I don't really know that I have the resources to make this as grand on film as I would, you know, doing physical art, you know, a comic book or something of that nature.
Right.
I think of, you know, Superman Returns and just that one scene, if you can remember, where Superman gets shot in the eye up close. That was $1 million scene.
Oh, my.
So,
yeah, that's expensive.
$1 million Yeah, just to do that one little frame by frame where the guy holds the gun to his face, you know, and the bullet crushes and crumples against his eye. So I really wanted to make sure that when I communicate the message, it has a really good aesthetic to it. And I thought comics would be the most feasible way to do that, and also very easy to share. You know, it's very easy for people to share around a PDF or, you know, someone have a comic book on their shelf in their home and, you know, just check it out.
Awesome.
Now, are you going the traditional route of publishing by going to Marvel or DC or one of the well-established comic companies? Or
no, I would never do that.
You know, more of a self-published sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely self-publish. I would never deal with... I mean, now, I would say Marvel has been better in recent years, but for a long time, you know, the intellectual property aspects of comic books and, you know, using what they have was very tense. And I actually have a good friend of mine who does costuming, and he built a really great Iron Man suit, and he just recently, you know, ran to Stanley at a comic convention. Stanley comes up and says, oh, that's great, and science is, you know, fully made amazing suit. And the dynamics of intellectual property have been changing, as you've seen in recent years, where a lot of people are now switching how they view people's adoptions and adaptations of their work, because it just spurs interest. You know, people like to be able to, you know, use the comic images, things from Marvel and, you know, other series to, you know, adopt and make their own sketches of and build their own suits from. And I think Marvel done a really good job of embracing that and realizing that really spurs business, as opposed to DC, which they've been a little bit more hesitant to approve people making their own things and not being officially DC licensed or approved. So I would never go, you know, with what any organization or anything like that where I felt they would try to take control of the project or take the gusto out of the voluntarist message, because to me that's everything. You know, if it doesn't have that underlying and you know, also on the face motif of liberty loving and fighting a government, that's not gonna fly. So I really want to maintain its integrity by just self-publishing, releasing online, and if I need to do print, you know, through a self-published service like Couple Amherst, something of that nature.
Are you going to release this under Creative Commons?
Yeah, it'll be, I think I can do it on Scribd pretty easily, but I want to just release it in wherever service I can get, you know, good uptime that's free that everybody can, you know, just pull it off of.
Well, awesome.
Creative Commons is a license, and it's what I use for pretty much everything that I publish. It allows you to maintain your copyright, but at the same time, it allows you to basically open it up and say, go ahead, give this away, make photocopies of it, sell it if you want to, but just make sure that I'm attributed as the author.
Sure, yeah. I mean, as far as I believe in, as a voluntarist, I don't believe in constricting people by intellectual property. I think there's a difference between piracy and stealing. Stealing is taking away something physical from somebody, whereas, piracy is somebody making a copy. And so, obviously, along with my beliefs, people, I have no problem that making one make copies or share it or modify it or, put their own little storyline to it. That's perfectly fine, of course, and I'd support that. And, of course, it would be great. I think people know who made it, so I think that'll be pretty obvious.
Awesome. Well, I think this is a great project. I love comics myself, and I grew up reading, Marvel and DC as well with all the famous superheroes. And I still go watch all the silly superhero movies because I love them still. It reminds me of being a kid. And so I think you've got a broad base there of people who have grown up with comics. And as well as a new generation of kids, that are coming up. Like my son is 16. He'll be 17 in November. And I think this might be something that he would really enjoy. So this would be something that I would, provide for him as well.
Oh, no, that's awesome. And actually, on that note, it inspired me when I was in New York a few weeks ago. I was at Midtown Comics and I was just, browsing through and just realizing how few comics these days actually have really deep, substantive content. I mean, these days the comic publishers are just relying on, extreme sex or extreme violence or just trying to rehash like really silly political things. And there's nobody out there that's really going deep into philosophical aspects of, why we do what we do. What does it mean to be free and what the government's actually doing? Nobody's really, touching that deep. We don't have too many people who are even Alan Moore-esque, who created V for Vendetta and Watchmen. There aren't people that are, really diving into those issues. And so I thought it was about time that somebody put something together that actually keeps the entertainment value, but now gets back into something that people can not feel guilty reading. They're not going to sit there and say, well, that was just a waste of time just to,
or a giant,
read through some action.
Or a giant philosophical tome.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just saying, I want it to be something that makes people think. That's really important to how it's presented, is that I want it to be provocative and to, of course, be entertaining, but at the same time get people to think about, what it is that's going on in the world and what their, position is in it.
Well, and I really like the idea of having more books, especially, graphic novel and comic book type of books, aimed at the libertarians, because how many times can you read, Animal Farm and 1984, or even, some stuff written by Mary Ruart
exactly.
before it just gets too repetitive?
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. And
welcome back to Voluntary Values. This is Daryl.
And this is Emberly.
And we are here live every Sunday from 3 to 5 p.m. on the Liberty Radio Network. You can find that online at lrn.fm. And there are affiliate stations across the country.
There
so
sure are.
If you live in an area where you can actually hear it on the FM or AM dial, then please listen that way. And give us a call at 603-435-1105. We would love to chat with you. And right now, Amberly, you have a story that you would like to share.
I sure do. And this is from techdirt.com. Homeland Security is issuing its own DMCA takedowns on YouTube to stifle speech. And what the DMCA is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. All right. So TechDirt has to say, we recently wrote about the fight over copyright fair use in political videos. In the comments, someone anonymous pointed us to a YouTube page, including a typical takedown notice. Here's a screenshot. So they show you a little screenshot from YouTube that has this kind of sad face, you know, looking thing. And it says, Obama calls for new. This video is no longer available because the YouTube account associated with this video has been terminated due to multiple third-party notifications of copyright infringement from claimants, including CBS, United States Department of Homeland Security. Sorry about that.
And the little face that it has, if you do the colon and the slash face.
Oh, is that what it is, the slash?
Yeah, it's the colon and the slash for kind of, not really sad, but kind of sad, sort of the,
aww.
Yeah, the, oh, sort of the puppy dog eyed sort of face. I'm really sad. I'm kind of sad. Yeah.
But it seems a little facetious at the same time.
Right, right. It is very weird that they would have that little face on there. But this is very interesting because I've actually run into problems with DMCA for my own works.
Oh, my.
Where one outlet doesn't like that I'm using another outlet to distribute my work. And so then it has the little box of, I swear or affirm that this is my work in compliance with DMCA, blah, 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 blah. And when possible, I try to waive any kind of rights. You know, so on Kindle, for example, when I upload works to Kindle or to Amazon for distribution on Kindle, there's a little box that I can click to waive the DMCA, meaning that people can then borrow and transfer the Kindle book.
Oh,
so if
nice.
You had a Kindle and I had a Kindle, I could send the book to you using the Kindle.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, and Amazon, as bad as Amazon is on some things, they are getting really good about allowing sharing of books with the Kindle.
Well, it's not like we don't have sharing of books via our public libraries.
Right, right. And that's something. They basically, they set up a Kindle library where you can opt into and then say, you want to read a book, but you don't want to pay for it. If you're some special member with Amazon, you can then borrow the book and it will temporarily be on your device.
So like the libraries are doing now with e-publisher books, like digital books.
Yes.
Nice. That's great. Is there a fee associated with this special privilege in Amazon?
It's called Amazon Prime membership.
Yeah. So there must be a little
fee. Kind of fee with that. But it gets you, you know, special perks where you can borrow books. I think it gives you discounts on shipping. There are other things associated with that membership. I don't remember exactly what they all are because I'm definitely not doing an advertisement for Amazon. But having had experience with Amazon as a publisher and as an author, you know, I know a little bit about their behind the scenes sort of works.
Yeah, I understand. Okay, so the person who wrote this article for Tech Dirt says, this is actually the first time I can recall that I've seen a takedown that had multiple takedown notices. So it's interesting.
Multiple highlighted there.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So in quotations, multiple was in quotations. So it's interesting that YouTube even has such an error message. But really, what really caught my attention was the second claimant listed, United States Department of Homeland Security, in bold. Homeland Security issuing copyright takedowns? For what it's worth, the commenter who submitted this pointed us to another video, which they claim is the same as what was taken down. I have no idea if it's the same video or not, but it is some idiotic conspiracy mongering, taking one comment from a reporter completely out of context and pretending President Obama said it when he did not. I never understand conspiracy theories like that, but that's really neither here nor there. The real issue is, why is Homeland Security issuing takedowns? Works produced by the federal government, of course, can't have copyright. However, it is possible for the government to hold copyrights, mainly if someone else gets it and assigns it to the government. So it's possible that happened here, though it still seems like a strange move. If the video is the same as the other one pointed to, it's just conspiracy theory claptrap, and I don't see why DHS would even bother issuing a takedown. But even if we assume that the copyright itself and the takedown were legit, does this seem reasonable at all? having a government agency directly using a copyright claim to take down a video, especially when that group is DHS, in which National Internet Censor ICE exists. Is that the that's not the same acronym as the Immigration and Control? That seems weird. I don't think I've ever heard the Internet Censor ICE. I'm not sure what
clicking
that.
On the link for that, so okay. I can give you. And for what it's worth, I clicked on the video that it links to where it says pointed us to another video.
Mm-hmm.
And the words another video are actually a link. And the full title of the video that was taken down in that screenshot is Obama calls for new world order in Berlin - NWO new world order.
Hmm.
So maybe at top of the hour, I'll watch this video just to see what it's all about.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing it's some weird conspiracy thing. Just because whenever anybody uses the term New World Order,
yeah,
they're pretty much going down some weird conspiracy alley.
Exactly.
Not always.
But sometimes.
You know, Hulk Hogan and Kevin Nash and Scott Hall, when they were the New World Order in WCW.
Oh, Lord.
You know, that was not a conspiracy theory. They were the New World Order of wrestling.
They were just playing on the conspiracy theorists to get them to come watch worldwide wrestling or whatever it's called.
And what's funny is Ted Turner actually owned WCW
right back
then, and he's supposedly, you know, one of the big movers and shakers
within
the global elite and the Bilderberg and everything else.
Well, something I liked... Well, let's just go ahead and finish this article real quick because it has some more good points in it. So giving it the power to censor videos, too, just seems like it's going way too far. It's not as if Homeland Security is going to bring the work, quote unquote, to market to make money. So it's not like there's a, quote, impact on the market, unquote, for the work. The only reason to issue the takedown, no matter how accurate the claim is to silence speech. A government organization using government-granted monopoly to stifle speech may be all too common, but that doesn't mean it should pass by unremarked upon. I reached out to people at YouTube to see if they could explain why DHS appears to be issuing DMCA takedowns and got back the equivalent of a quote-unquote no comment. I also reached out to Homeland Security, who at first seemed interested in looking into the details and then completely stopped responding to emails. Having not received further communication from them in over a week at this point, I'm just going with the post as is in the hopes that maybe someone out there can explain why the federal government is using copyright to censor speech.
Okay, so I'm looking at this article that it linked to try to figure out exactly what ICE stands for. Nowhere do they actually give the definition. So I'm guessing it is the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. But why custom would even have anything to do with copyright dispute makes absolutely no sense, unless it's something dealing with some kind of weird criminal wiretapping something. They filmed me without my permission, so that's bad. Pull that video down. We'll try to figure out more about this coming up after this brief timeout here on Voluntary Values. Welcome back to Voluntary Values. This is Daryl.
And this is Emberly.
And you can chat with Emberly in the chat room for the webcam on LRN.fm.
You sure can.
And you can watch the webcam and see one lovely face. And
hey, everybody
me.
Out there.
And if you were watching, you just saw Emberly wave to you. So we've been talking about Homeland Security and the fact that apparently they are claiming copyright on some videos that are posted on YouTube.
First of all, the article says in the second paragraph, the real question is, why is Homeland Security issuing takedowns? Works produced by the federal government, of course, can't have copyright. However, it is possible for the government to hold copyrights. So what does that mean? Is there anybody out there listening that might have any idea about copyright issues in the federal government? Because I'm not understanding this at all.
Well, if you finish reading that sentence, it says, if someone else gets the copyright and then assigns it to the government.
Yeah, but what entity do you use? Just the government? So if I wanted to produce a piece of content, a video, say, so I make this video and then I want to assign it to the government in general, do I just say the government?
Well, it would depend on which governmental agency. You could give your copyright to the EPA, the FBI, the CIA, the IRS, DHS, the Pentagon, the Army, the Navy, the
never
Marines.
Never mind. I don't want to do that. I'll keep my stuff to myself.
You could give it to any of the various... governmental agencies at the federal, state, county, or municipal level. And there are millions to choose from. So,
literally.
I read a study not too terribly long ago that said that there are now more government agencies in the United States than there were in the Soviet Union before its collapse.
Well, does that really surprise you?
Not really.
I mean, it's a little frightening to think about, especially since, you know, we're supposed to live in the land of the free and the home of the brave, which I like to lovingly call the land of the fee and the home of the slave, because that's really what it is. But, you know, when you think about it, you know, if we have more, you know, departments of this or that, whatever acronym you want to use, than the Soviet Union did, are we really free?
No.
I mean, the Soviet Union, I mean, the United States is a big country with lots of people in it, over 300 million people. But the Soviet Union at the time was, I mean, what, two or three times larger than the United States with
probably
more people? And so they had less government than we did, or we do now. That's amazing. Yeah. That makes me sad and scared at the same time. We had the odds stacked against us because now we have so many more institutions to, you know, to dismantle in what ways we can, you know.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean peaceful ways, non-violent ways. So for all of you, I just want you to understand that we are peaceful people, not violent.
Well, and I think secession is probably one of the best ways to go about dismantling governments. And, you know, I take secession all the way from, you know, the regional, state, county, municipal, down to the individual.
Right. You start with seceding yourself, and then you move on from there.
Well,
you're speechless.
Hold on. No, I'm just trying to formulate an intelligent sentence here. Because I actually did try to secede.
Yourself?
Myself from the federal government,
well,
in like 1994, 95. But because I did not follow the Department of State's procedure by first leaving territory that the U.S. government claims.
Those arbitrary lines.
And then going to the U.S. consulate in whatever country and saying, I'm no longer a citizen. They didn't recognize that. When I say secession down to the individual level, I think that states should have the right to secede from the federal government. Counties should have the right to secede from the state. Towns should have the right to secede from the county.
Mm-hmm.
And individuals should have the right to secede from the town.
Or from all of the above.
Right.
Well, when I made that little comment about, you know, first you have to secede yourself, I really meant that is a state of mind more than anything else.
Okay. I thought you meant as like a political... Here's my declaration of secession that no one will ever recognize.
No.
Because I've tried that.
I don't need... But here's the difference. I don't need any government whatsoever to tell me that, you know, they have power or not over me. I'll make that decision whether they have power or not over me. So, you know, I mean, you can't fully succeed, but you can in your mind. You can make those steps to start down that path.
Right.
And I
right.
think that's the most important message that, you know, can be sent out to people right now, is that you don't have to live in this statist world. You know, you can start a revolution in your own head and go from there.
Right. But, you know, at the same time, there are practical things to where, let's just say, and I don't necessarily follow the speed limit all the time, but because I live in a jurisdiction where, you know, some group of people decided that there is a speed limit,
right,
there are repercussions for, you know, trying to live free. So to make sure that everybody realizes.
Right. I still, you know, obey traffic laws. I still have a driver's license. You know, my car is registered. All of those things. It has tags. I mean, so without putting myself into a cage,
right,
I live as free as I possibly can,
right,
without
living
in a cage.
There are some people that, you know, I've had conversations with people and they're like, nope, I don't obey any law. Well, do you have that? Well, yeah, I've got a driver's license, but, you know, like, I don't obey their laws. They have no power over them. But then they start admitting all these different things that they do comply with.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm just coming at it from a realistic perspective.
Of course.
You know, you realistically have to, you know, you don't have to do anything. But if you don't, then there are consequences.
Right.
And there are some people that just don't want to admit that there are consequences.
Well, there's consequences for every action that we take, no matter how small or minute,
right,
or how large. So you have to really, and by what I meant by starting a revolution in your mind is you have to really look at what is most important in your life and what you want for your life.
Right.
And that's the first step. It takes that, and then you can do everything else from there. You can make decisions on how far you want to go from there. You know, I don't want to end up in a cage, so I stay within the bounds of some laws that I need to avoid going into a cage. And just because I don't want to go into a cage. I mean,
right,
I don't,
right,
want to be in jail. That's my main motivator.
Well, and I shouldn't say I don't know of anybody, because I have met people in the past that did like being in jail because they were being fed and clothed and... Otherwise,
right, they don't
have
to,
would have been homeless.
Right, they don't have to do anything for themselves. They lack personal responsibility. And that's why they like going to jail. And there's a lot of people, unfortunately, in the world that have been institutionalized into thinking that way, that they get three hots and a cot. You know, I mean, how many times have you heard that little statement, you know, from people?
A lot.
Yeah, and it's kind of sad because that's an institutionalized form of thinking. And, you know, we have institutions all across the United States and the world, and, you know, the most famous of institutions besides prisons are schools, you know, and where you first learn where you have to sit still and be quiet and do what you're told and, memorize this.
At the beginning of the day, you have to say the Pledge of Nationalism. I mean, the Pledge of Allegiance.
Right. The pledge. Yeah. Oh. Check out the Whitest Kids You Know. Their video on the Pledge of Allegiance is hysterical and frightening at the same time.
You know, I might actually play that on the air at the top of the next hour.
Yeah, that is a great... You don't even have to see the video. You just have to hear the words that are being said. It's fantastic.
And if you listen to LRN enough, you will hear that occasionally during the top of the hour news updates.
Oh, yes, you do.
The 1 minute onion clips. But I'll pull that up and we'll play that at the top of the next hour. The Whitest Kids You Know Pledge of Allegiance. It is hilarious. And, you know, it breaks it down. Using satire, it basically breaks down all of the indoctrination that takes place in these schools.
Yeah.
And if anybody's ever actually researched the history of public education, it has absolutely nothing to do with educating children.
No, it sure doesn't.
It has to do with basically creating daycares for kids so that then both parents can go work.
Yep. Institutionalized daycare. Yep. Gotta love it.
And if anybody's ever wondered why they have the summer months off, it was because it came about in the agrarian culture,
yep,
where the kids had to actually go work on the farm during the summer.
That's right.
So we'll come back in the next hour here on Voluntary Values. Welcome back to Voluntary Values with Daryl and Emberly, here every Sunday from 3 to 5 p.m. on the Liberty Radio Network. And in the last hour, we promised that we would play the Whitest Kids You Know Pledge of Allegiance. So if you've never heard this,
you're in for a treat.
And you're in for a treat.
Kids, now come and get your Ritalin.
So if you have never heard that before, I want you to call in at 603-435-1105 and tell me how hard you laughed.
Because if you were looking at the webcam, you could see Daryl and I just dying laughing, and it never loses its appeal. It's always funny every time I see it.
I've heard that dozens of times, and it is still funny.
Yes, of course it is. It makes me laugh, and it makes me think too, so that's great. But
and then you notice things every time you hear it that you didn't hear before.
Right.
Like, I didn't realize that they mentioned Johnson & Johnson there before. I knew that they mentioned GE and Citigroup. And at the end, amen. Like, they're saying a prayer.
Exactly. You know, well, isn't that what the Pledge of Allegiance really is, though, when you really look
really
at it?
It's not creepy to have little kids mindlessly recite this before they know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not creepy.
Not at all.
It's not a form of brainwashing. And for anybody that has actually read the history of the Pledge of Allegiance, the actual real one that children do say every day in school, it was written by a socialist. And before the socialists start calling, let me clarify, it was written by a national socialist. But to be a national socialist, you must be a socialist. So it was written basically as, and that's why I call it the Pledge of Nationalism.
Right.
And it was written in such a way to where it could be used by any country at anywhere in the world. It did not mention to the Republic.
Right.
It just says, I pledge allegiance to my flag.
To the flag.
No, the original version.
Oh, the original one said my flag. Oh, so basically the United States government just kind of tweaked it a bit.
They tweaked it.
Nice.
And then added, and to the Republic for which it stands. And then many years later, they added one nation under God.
Right. I know that wasn't originally in there.
One nation indivisible.
Right.
But then it was changed to one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Amen. Come get your Ritalin.
Children, come get your Ritalin. And I will say that I've had a child in public education. And when he was in first grade, you know, his teacher, whose name I will never forget or face I will ever forget, probably until I'm dead, I will never forget this woman because that's how crazy she made me. She was convinced that my 7-year-old son in first grade was ADHD and needed Ritalin. So I went back and forth and around, you know, we fought and fought and fought and fought and fought over this. And then they sent me to this, you know, psychiatrist to be evaluated, to have my son evaluated, who then of course agreed with the school that yes, my son needed Ritalin.
Of course.
So I said, you know what? I know my kid, you know, he is not hyperactive. He is a normal 7-year-old boy. You know, so I went and got two more what do you call them, referrals or
second opinion, third opinion.
I got a second and third opinion, exactly. Brain freeze. So I went and did that, and both of those doctors, who had good reputations as child psychologists and or psychiatrists, told me that my son was just fine and he did not need Ritalin or any other kind of nasty little drug that they like to give kids. So I took both of these doctors and the third doctor, the first doctor's notes, and showed them and said, I think we have a problem here. You know, and it turns out that the school was getting kickbacks from the federal government, one, and from the psychiatric practice for giving prescriptions, for sending kids, referring kids to this doctor. The doctor was getting kickbacks from the government, and the school was getting kickbacks in the form of extra funding, because the more kids they had on medication, the more money and funding they got, and they could
like
be a
special
needs children.
Yeah,
yeah, and they that way they were considered what's called a Title I school.
Ooh.
Yeah. Well, they eventually, and they were preying on boys, and especially Hispanic boys was one of the major things that they were doing. And so they eventually got shut down, and everyone on the staff got fired. From the principal on down to the janitor, everyone got fired, and all the teachers lost their licenses.
Well, I feel sorry for the janitor.
I feel sorry for the janitor, too, because I don't think the janitor had anything to do with what was going on. But who knows? You know, I mean, it's very depressing. But I want to get off the school thing here. And luckily, you know, I'm on the chat on LRN.com or LRN.FM. So, you know, I love it when I don't know something, and I have these great people that are on the chat, and they send me information. So we were concerned about what ICE was.
Yes.
You know, when I tried to look it up, all I got was, you know,
the immigration and customs enforcement.
You know, immigration people. So what it actually is, and this is from Wikipedia, is it's the Information and Content Exchange, and it's an XML-based protocol used for content syndication via the internet. By using XML, both sender and receiver have an agreed-upon language in which to communicate. The system uses a client-server architecture. On October 27, 1998, the completion of ICE 1.0 was announced at a press summit in San Francisco. In June 2004, a new web services compliant version, ICE 2.0, was released to support industrial strength syndication for the next generation of the web. Interesting.
That is very interesting. And thank you, whoever passed that information along to us.
Yeah, I don't know who it was. It just says LRN newbie 845. So thank you. And okay. LRN newbie 273 also put that in there. So great. Thanks.
All right. So those newbies are people that
that are on the chat
either
with me.
Chose not to use a username, or
right,
they have not yet registered a username.
Right. What's nice about the chat is that you don't actually have to register a username. You can just, like, I just go into it and use my regular name,
right,
and put it in there, and I don't have to enter a password or anything.
Right. But if you wanted to, you could actually register that username.
Ah.
That way nobody else could go into chat as E.M. McCullough.
Well, I use my first name, Emberly, so.
Okay. Well, nobody could go in as Emberly.
Well, hopefully no one else will go in as me.
Maybe I will.
Daryl's going to go in and troll using my name.
I will sabotage the chat by registering Emberly and then making it a password that I will never remember and then never use it again.
Okay, so we've got about 1 minute till we have to go on our next break. And I wanted to let you know about Taryn Lupo's new book, One Nation Under Blood. When a rejuvenative blood technology is developed that pits the young against the old, the government must take firm steps to address the war of supply and demand brewing across generational lines. Blood is not the only thing bought and sold in this dystopian tale of technology, economics, and independence. Vampires are now very real, but we never expected them to wear our grandmother's best Sunday dress. You can find it at any major online realtors on Halloween. So go out and get Taryn Lupo's new book. This is Voluntary Values.
We'll be back momentarily here on LRN.FM. Welcome back to Voluntary Values. This is Daryl.
And this is Emberly.
And we are here live every Sunday from 3 to 5 p.m. on LRN, the Liberty Radio Network, online at LRN.FM. You can go there, look at the webcam, join the chat, Or you can give us a call at 603-435-1105. Give us a call. Talk to us about pretty much anything. Right now we've been talking about... What have we been talking about?
Well, we kind of ran the gamut there. We started off talking about a about the Homeland Security,
yes,
and the DMSA, or DMCA.
DMCAs, yes.
And then we ended with an brain freeze again. We ended with
something
the
about
description.
Education and,
well, we ended with the description.
You know.
No, the last segment we ended with a description of what the ICE is. ICE.
Yes. Yes. The internet something enforcement. I do not remember. I have
it's the information and content exchange.
The internet censoring.
Yeah.
Enforcers.
Well, it's really not. It's more like some kind of XML. And I don't even pretend to know when I read all of that what any of that meant.
I'm
not a computer programmer, so I have no idea.
Is. XML is some file type where if you were to download an entire website, it would download that generally in an XML file.
Oh, okay, I understand.
I don't know. Maybe
bit.
The very cute Taryn Lupo knows this and can.
Oh
call
yes,
in and
the
tell
very
us.
Very cute Taryn Lupo out in Savannah, who's writing lots and lots of stories that some of them I hear are crowdsourced.
Yes.
So
pretty much everything is crowd. He'll post on Facebook. I need the name of a character. Somebody tell me what that character did.
We love him for it, though. And
or as
and,
Bob Murphy said at Porkfest. Why don't you just tell me the novel you would like me to write?
Let me Google that for you. Let me write that for you, Taryn. Anyway.
We do love you, Taryn.
Yes, we do.
We pick on the people that we mildly tolerate most of the time.
And some exciting news is that Taryn will be live on the show on the 28th. So 2 weeks from this Sunday.
Oh, that's 2 days before the release of One Nation Under Blood.
I believe it's 3 days. It's actually getting released on Halloween. Remember, Halloween's on the 31st.
Right. He's got an event scheduled for the 30th.
Oh, well, maybe he tricked me and just told me it was being released on Halloween just to make me look stupid.
I don't know.
Thanks,
Taryn.
One of
us is wrong.
Anyway, his new book will be out at the end of October.
Yeah, his book's coming out at the end of the month. And he's going to be on the last Sunday of the month.
Okay, so he just sent me a message and he said the 30th. So when I read the little ad there a few minutes ago, I was wrong. It's not Halloween. It's the 30th. The 30th.
Yes.
So go to any major online bookstore and purchase his new book, One Nation Under Blood.
If you go to Amazon... From the sidebar ad on fpp.cc, then we get a little kickback from that.
Awesome. And I just wanted to say that Taryn is helping to, he's helping us to, you know, financially support the show. And that's why we're, you know, talking about him today so much. And I read that little blurb about his new book because he's actually an advertiser. So when he gets us his ad for the website, it'll be on the website and then you'll be able to click a link to go straight to him.
Yes.
All right.
And Amberly, you wanted to talk about a administrative warrant or administrative subpoena.
Right.
That
so
apparently, I'm guessing this is part of the Patriot Act.
Something like that. Someone sent this to me and said, hey, I think this would be something that you're interested in. So I took a look at it. And this is from Wired.com. And it says... We don't need no stinking warrant, the disturbing unchecked rise of the administrative subpoena. And it's got quite a scary picture of some DEA agents bashing in a door. So that's quite a frightening picture there. It says, okay, so when Golden Valley Electric Association of Rural Alaska got an administrative subpoena from the Drug Enforcement Administration in December 2010, seeking electricity bill information on three customers, the company did what it usually does with subpoenas. It ignored them.
Way to go, Golden Valley Electric Association.
Right on. That's the association's customer privacy policy because administrative subpoenas aren't approved by a judge. But by law, utilities must hand over customer records, which include any billing and payment information, phone numbers, and power consumption data, to the DEA without court warrants if drug agents believe the data is, quote unquote, relevant to an investigation. So the utility eventually complied after losing a legal fight earlier this month. Meet the administrative subpoena. With a federal official's signature, with a federal official's, let me just make sure to stress that point, a federal official's signature, banks, hospitals, bookstores, telecommunications companies, and even utilities and internet service providers, virtually all businesses, are required to hand over sensitive data on individuals or corporations as long as the government agent declares the information is relevant to an investigation. Via a wide range of laws, Congress has authorized the government to bypass the Fourth Amendment, the constitutional guard against unreasonable searches and seizures that requires a probable cause warrant signed by a judge.
Okay, and I've actually heard Judge Napolitano speak on this briefly. And there is a provision in the USA Patriot Act, which most people just call the Patriot Act, that says that basically any government official, and by government official, they mean any FBI agent, any CIA agent, anyone working for the DEA, basically anyone with a government job,
right,
can sign their own subpoenas and sign their own warrants.
That's a little fascist, doesn't it feel? I mean, it has a scary kind of fascist feel to it.
Yes.
I mean, so if...
You know, at least here in Keene, the code enforcer goes to his buddy that wears the robe and has his buddy sign the piece of paper before they break into my house.
Yeah, well, that's not any fun anyway. They still broke into your house anyway.
Right.
Scumbags.
But at least they, you know, went through the proper procedures of having, you know, two guys sign the piece of paper.
Instead of just one indiscriminate person who can sign it.
You know, instead of the code enforcer being able to sign his own warrants, which I'm glad he can't do.
Because he would sign warrants for probably every house in Keene if he, business.
Probably just this one.
Or just the house that Daryl lives in. That's a little crazy.
Yeah, so if you happen to be in Keene, Tuesday morning at 8:30, come down to Keene District Court and watch some circus go on, because they're probably going to throw my lawsuit against the city out, but I'm going to have fun before it gets thrown out.
There you go. And I wish I could be there, but I have a job interview in Nashua. But I'll be there for the What's Happening on Tuesday as well.
The Cheshire County Candidates Forum. In the Keene Public Library's Ruth Huntress Auditorium from 2 to 4, 27 candidates were invited. 9 have agreed to attend. There will be question and answer. Well, 1/3 is actually pretty good. That's
still think that you would get a better turnout for a candidate forum. That's sad.
Yeah. And there will be a straw poll that takes place.
Nice. So make sure you show up Tuesday if you live in Cheshire County.
Yeah. And we'll talk more about the administrative subpoenas coming up in the next segment here on Voluntary Values. Voluntary Values. This is Daryl.
And this is Emberly. Hey, make sure that you check us out on Facebook at Voluntary Values and at voluntaryvalues.com.
All right. You totally made me lose my train of
thought.
We've been talking about administrative subpoenas.
Yes, we have.
That government agents can issue basically to themselves.
Right.
And there's one specific situation that this article talks about, where back in 2010, the Golden Valley Electric Association was given some subpoenas by the DEA. They ignored them. And then in August of this year, they lost a court battle saying that they must turn over utility and other electrical bill information to the DEA so that the DEA can then decide if people are growing some marijuana.
Or running a meth lab, more than likely. Because, you know, meth labs, I think take up a lot of power. But so does growing marijuana in your house.
I don't think meth labs take up that much power. You just need a lot of chemicals.
Oh, is that
and
it?
And then if you don't mix them right, that's why things blow up.
I'm no Breaking Bad guy, so I don't run a meth lab out of my house. Sorry to all those who thought I might be an expert.
I started watching Breaking Bad not too long ago.
Yeah, you like it?
I just started the second season. The first season started off kind of slow.
Yeah, I like the first season.
But I think
it's an interesting show.
I think it's definitely getting better, and maybe by the end of the year I'll be completely caught up with the first five and then have to wait until Netflix puts the final season on.
Or you could just pirate it. Oh,
I would never do that.
Me either. I don't do things like that.
But
I'm a good girl.
If someone happened to have those files on their computer and said, hey, I can show you the final season.
So we're going to get out of illegal talk before DEA comes knocking down our door, or DHS or any other alphabet soup agency comes knocking down our doors to find out what we're stealing and or not stealing. It all depends on your ideas and thoughts on IP. though, so that's another discussion for another time.
Copying is not theft.
So if
I steal your bicycle, then you take the bus. But if I copy your bicycle, there's one for each of us.
That's true. That's
copying
very true.
Copying is not theft.
Nice. I like that.
I don't remember who wrote that, but if you Google copying isn't theft, then
you'll get the whole little.
Watch the YouTube video. Nice. And.
All right, so back to the administrative subpoenas article. So the article goes on to say that, in fact, there are roughly 335 federal statutes on the books passed by Congress giving dozens upon dozens of federal agencies the power of the administrative subpoena, according to interviews and government reports. So a gentleman named Joe Evans, the utilities attorney, says, I think this is out of control. What has happened is, unfortunately, these statutes have been on the books for many, many years and the courts have acquiesced. So anecdotal evidence suggests that federal officials from a broad spectrum of government agencies issue them hundreds of thousands of times annually, but none of the agencies are required to disclose fully how often they actually utilize them, meaning there is little, if any, oversight of this tactic that's increasingly used in the war on drugs, the war on terror, and seemingly the war on Americans' constitutional rights to be free from unreasonable government trespass into their lives. That's despite proof that FBI agents given such powers under the Patriot Act quickly began to abuse them and illegally collected Americans' communications records, including those of reporters. Two scathing reports in the Justice Department's Inspector General uncovered routine and pervasive illegal use of administrative subpoenas by FBI anti-terrorism agents given nearly carte blanche authority to demand records about Americans' communications with no supervision. When the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, perhaps the nation's most liberal appeals court based in San Francisco, ordered Golden Valley to fork over the data earlier this month, the court said the case was, quote unquote, easily decided because the records were, quote unquote, relevant to a government drug investigation. Oh, my goodness. With the data the Alaska utility handed over, the DEA may then use further administrative subpoenas to acquire the suspected indoor dope growers' phone records, stored emails, and perhaps credit card purchasing histories, all to build a case to acquire a probable case warrant, to physically search their homes and businesses. So basically what this administrative subpoena does, it's a fishing expedition.
Yes.
That's sickening. So, you know, they can't gather enough probable cause to, you know, go to a judge and get a warrant to go search their house. So now they're going through a backdoor way to look at all of your records. So what you're buying, what you're using your power for, how much power you're using.
Right.
How many people are at your house? What are they going to do next?
Well, they might put cameras in the toilet to see what, you know, you put in there.
Well, they don't want to see what I put in my toilet, so
no
I don't think they want to see what anyone else. But, you know, they might because, you know, some of us might enjoy, you know, eating some cannabis every now and then. And that would be one way that they could probably determine whether that person is utilizing the cannabis drug is by filming our, you know, toilets. Oh, that is just disgusting. I don't want to further that anymore. Okay,
and
so
I only said that just to see what reaction I would get from you because I love seeing you turn like 57 shades of red.
Well, my embarrassment is fun for many people. I'm glad you enjoy.
Oh, and by the way, the Copying Is Not Theft song and video is done by Nina Paley.
Nice. Way to go, Nina Paley. All right. So apparently the administrative subpoena doesn't just apply to utility records and drug cases. Congress has spread the authority across a huge swath of the U.S. government for investigating everything from hazardous waste disposal, the environment, atomic energy, child exploitation, food stamp fraud, medical insurance fraud, terrorism, securities violations, satellites, SEALs, student loans, and for breaches of dozens of laws pertaining to fruits, vegetables, livestock, and crops.
Student loans, because, you know, if you're using your student loan money to major in chemistry and horticulture at the same time,
ooh, you might be a drug dealer.
Obviously, it's so that you can then be more proficient at growing the marijuana, cooking the meth, and turning cocaine into crack.
Wow.
I guess. I have absolutely no clue what any of this actually means. I'm just grasping at straws the same way they are.
Mm-mm-mm. And this is quite a long article. It's got 3 pages, so we're not going to get into the entire article. But if you want to take a look at this article and read it all, it's actually a very good, kind of very scary article. And it has a lot of links that are highlighted in blue so that you can do further research. And I love sites like this that do this for you. I think this is wonderful because it takes the, you know, a lot of the time away and from having to do it yourself, which is great. So thank you to David Kravitz from Wired.com. And you can find that. You just go Google it, administrative subpoenas on their website, or search for administrative subpoenas on their website.
Now, and I scrolled down to the bottom of the first page, and there's a quote from Ava Cooper Davis, who in 2006 was the DEA's deputy assistant administrator.
Oh, yeah.
And she told a congressional hearing, "The administrative subpoena must have a DEA case file, be signed by the investigator supervisor, and be given a sequential number for recording in a logbook or computer database so that a particular field office can track and account for any administrative subpoenas issued by that office."
Oh, it sounds like bureaucracy, bureaucracy, bureaucracy.
So apparently, you know, the DEA can't sign their... Well, you know, a DEA agent can't sign his own warrant, but he can just go to his supervisor and say, "Hey, boss, sign this real quick."
Yeah, and how many of us, you know, especially administrative people, have went to their bosses and said, "I need you to sign this," and do they ever look at it? They just sign it.
No.
You know, so, yeah, you know, I've been in that position before, and I'm not even in a government agency, but I've seen that happen even in corporations, so... You know, that's a little frightening.
Well, how many people actually read anything that they sign?
I would say very few people. And you know what? I'm guilty of that as well. So, I mean, I know.
You know, sign up for something and check the little box. Yeah, I've read your terms of service.
No, all the time.
Never look at it.
All the time.
So we'll come back. We might talk about terms of service in the last segment. Not really sure. We'll be back shortly here on Voluntary Values. Welcome back to Voluntary Values with Daryl and Emberly, and we just came up with our own terms of service, so we're going to read those off to you right now. By listening to this show, you agree to give Daryl and Emberly $100 a month. If you fail to do so within 30 days, then we will seek court action to have you give quadruple the amount every 3 days instead of every month. By failing to do that, then you owe us your soul, and we can revoke your kidneys at any time. Okay, so we've been talking about administrative warrants and copyright and some other things. And Emberly, you wanted to share something that was really interesting that you saw today.
I did. And thank you to Daryl for disclosing this information to me earlier today. It was really interesting. For those of you who don't know, Felix Baumgartner, in association with Red Bull,
the Red Bull Stratos,
right, jumped from the edge of space today. It was
what was the official jump height? It was somewhere near 40 miles up, I believe.
It was 24 and a half miles high.
Okay, because the last time I saw the elevation thing, while I was in the midst of doing several other things. I thought he was somewhere near 30 miles at one point.
I don't think he got quite that high, and they had to depressurize the cabin, which brought it down some and leveled it out so that he could have a more level way to jump out. And it was incredible. At first, I told Daryl, no way I'm going to watch this. I'll probably throw up. It'll be way too, you know, emotionally involving. And I tell you, it was very emotional watching this man get ready to jump out of this cabin. And, you know, because he could have easily died.
Yes.
Easily. Luckily, he did not.
I believe I read that he reached a speed of 726 miles per hour, which at the elevation he was at may have broken the sound barrier.
May have. They have to do some calculations to come up with that final analysis.
If he did break the sound barrier, and even if he didn't, today is 65 years to the day from the time that Chuck Yeager first broke the sound barrier in an airplane.
Oh, that's exciting. I didn't know that.
So the fact that, you know, the first human breaking the sound barrier outside of any powered thing.
Yeah.
Happening 65 years to the day after the first time the sound barrier was broken. That's just... It's amazing.
It is amazing.
And then you had a quote from Felix. Can you share that real quick?
Oh, let me go back to where I can find that.
So if you're not familiar with the Red Bull Stratos, then you can just, you know, look online, Red Bull Stratos, or I'm looking at the Facebook page right now, which is facebook.com/Red Bull Stratos. And some facts, the altitude from which he jumped was 128,097 feet. The duration of free fall was 4 minutes and 19 seconds. The total jump time was 9 minutes and 3 seconds.
It was very exciting. Oh, and I'm having an error. I can't get on Facebook.
And the max speed was 1,137 kilometers per hour.
Yeah, he did not beat the record for free fall, but he did have the longest and farthest jump in history.
Right.
And so the fact that he might have broken the sound barrier would be another accomplishment.
Okay, what was the free fall thing that you were saying? He did not break the free fall?
The free fall record. A man named Kittinger actually broke the free fall record. That's the amount of time that before they pull the chute, from the time they drop out to before they pull the chute.
Oh, okay. So
and so he missed it by literally 9 seconds.
Okay, and I believe Kittinger is the one that... For nearly 60 years has held the skydiving record.
Yeah, something like that, where he had the longest. Yeah. I cannot get back on Facebook. I do apologize to find that quote.
Okay, but
anyway,
the quote, just to paraphrase the quote, was everyone has limits, but not everyone accepts them.
Something like that. Yeah, it was a really nice quote from Felix Baumgartner. And, you know, it was very emotional watching his family in the mission control room, you know, and seeing his mother. I mean, I can identify because I'm a mother and I would not want my son to do this. All right. But on another note, on something that I found that I wanted to discuss with you guys is... This young man this very Christian young man decided that he was going to live a year as a gay man. So a Christian straight man decided to live a year as a gay man, and he wrote a book about it. And he's got a video on abcnews.go.com, which is really good, called Cross in the Closet, Straight Christian Lives a Year as Gay Man. And then it tells you basically the transcript of the article. So this young man, his name is Timothy Couric. He was taught the lesson of God's wrath in the biblical story of Sodom and Gomorrah, and he believed that homosexuality was a sin. He said, "You learn to be very afraid of God. According to the preachings of his church, the loving thing to do is tell my friend who is gay, hey, listen, you're an abomination, and you need to repent to go to heaven. I absolutely believe that in that lock, stock, and barrel." So devout was Couric as a teen that friends' parents would often call him to set their kids straight if they misbehaved or broke what they believed to be God's law. "I would be the one on the phone until 4 a.m. asking them to repent for their sins," he said. But about 4 years ago, when a lesbian he knew from a karaoke night confided to him that her parents had disowned her when she came out, Couric felt that he failed her. "I feel God really kicked me in the gut," he said. "She was crying in my arms, and instead of being there for her, I was thinking about all the arguments to convert her." Couric's reaction ate away at him, and he wondered what it felt like to be gay and so alone. So even though Couric identifies as straight, he embarked on what one religious writer called, quote unquote, spiritual espionage. He would live like a gay man for a year. It finally clicked, he said. I needed to empathize and understand. Now 26 and no longer homophobic, Couric writes about his journey, one that included hanging out in gay bars and facing the disappointment of his family and rejection of his friends in his memoir, The Cross in the Closet. He chose today, which this article came out October 11th, says he chose today National Coming Out Day and LGBT National History Month. I can't even believe I didn't know that. I feel so disappointed. I didn't read all the way down the article before. Wow, that's scary. He chose today to launch the book sales and has pledged to give some of the proceeds to a charity that helps LGBT youth who are homeless. He says he hopes to change minds, not just in the Christian community, but in the LGBT one as well, and to bridge the divide in the debate over gay rights. So how wonderful is this young man, you know, that had this kind of spiritual conversion in a way where he saw the hurt that being homosexual can put on people.
I'm really curious and would like to read his book just to find out. Just to find out, it said something about what was the last thing about gay rights? How's that sentence worded?
To bridge the divide in the debate over gay rights.
Okay, here's how I see things, and I'm pretty sure that you agree, and most people that ascribe to a voluntary philosophy do agree. Individuals have rights.
Yes.
Groups cannot have any more rights than any individual. So
right. I see where you're going with this, but you're thinking in the, this article is written in the context of everyday people who don't necessarily ascribe to what we believe in.
Right. But from a governmental perspective, you know, governments try to give certain groups more rights.
Yes, so they do.
When people
it's
talk
called divide
about,
and conquer.
Right. But when people talk about gay right, they're talking about, you know, the whatever privilege or whatever that governments try to get of, if you don't give somebody a job and they happen to be gay, then you violated their rights because you did not hire a gay person.
Right.
Whereas maybe you didn't know that the person was gay.
Well, there has
and they
to be,
just weren't qualified.
There has to be a demonstrated reason. The demonstrated bias towards that person as a gay person in order for them to be disqualified for a job in that manner
I'm just saying if you happen to not hire the person and they happen to be gay
but the person interviewer has
file a lawsuit and cost you thousands
doesn't
of
mean
dollars
they'll win,
in
though.
Legal fees
well that's
right.
true yeah
but they can cost you thousands of dollars in legal fees so the threat of lawsuits a lot of times causes people to maybe hire someone that is less qualified that happens to belong to one of these quote unquote protected groups.
Right.
So, you know, what I'm saying is basically, you know, everyone should be equal under the law. If somebody wants to open up a restaurant and hang a big sign out front that says, "I don't serve gay people,"
then they should be allowed
they
to.
They should be allowed to do that.
Yeah,
and I should
I agree.
Be allowed to open up a restaurant right across the street that says, "I don't care what color you are or what you do in your bedroom. I will serve you."
Yes.
And I'm going to do it at a lower price than the guy that doesn't want to.
All right, so that actual quote from Felix Baumgartner was, "Everyone has limits. Not everyone accepts them." And it's a beautiful picture of him flying through space.
I'm sure it is. And join us next week here on LRN.FM. This is Daryl and Emberly, and this is Voluntary Values.
Peace and love.